being selected by Jenny Finch and her team for the Book of the Month is quite frankly one of the pinnacles of any writer's ambition. Don't ask me how I know this. I just do.
This month's Book of the Month is 3 Hours by Rosamund Lupton. 3 Hours is the fourth novel by Rosamund Lupton and was chosen by the Times newspaper as their Thriller of the Year in 2020. Opening with a moment of stillness and calm, it rapidly turns into a whirlwind of action and characters. Set in a school in rural Somerset in the middle of a blizzard, it tells the story of an attack by several unknown gunmen who blank out the security camera and begin their siege by shooting the headmaster. Pupils are scattered through the grounds, some in the library where the headmaster collapses, slowly bleeding to death, some in the theatre where a group are rehearsing Macbeth, ready for the evening's performance, and a group of the youngest trapped in a flimsy outbuilding with the pottery teacher.
11:10 a.m. In the library, Frank is next to Ed. Their backs against the books and the door. He hasn't tried pushing it again. Perhaps he won't try again. Please let him not try again. It's funny. Up until today, Frank and Louisa have never been close, not in the way that twins are meant to be. No secret language, nothing like that. But earlier she emailed him that she loves him, which she's never said before, or anything like it. He's always thought Louisa was embarrassed of him. Perhaps she still is. But it doesn't matter. He thinks the footsteps are outside Mrs. Cale's classroom, and feels guilty for his relief that they're not outside the library door. Tries to justify his relief as knowing that the English classroom has desks as a barricade, so more protection than they do, but knows that isn't the truth. Anna is with Mr. Marr, stroking his face lightly, and Frank can tell she feels useless, that she thinks stroking his face isn't helping, but if it was him, he'd like it. And not only because it would be Hannah doing it, but because another person's touch is comforting. And he thinks Mr. Marr can feel the kindness in it. When Louisa and people in the theatre emailed them questions about Mr. Marr, they said that he's injured, but will be okay, because they need to believe that. A new email on his laptop from Benny in the theatre. Benny's spoken to Raffi, he says, and his voice is startling to himself and to everyone else in the library, because no one has been talking, and if they do so, it's in whispers. He wanted Raffi to come to the theatre, but Raffi said he couldn't, said his little brother's missing. Percy wasn't evacuated? Anna asks him, and he wants to lie to her but can't. No, he wanted to be with Raffi, so Raffi's in the woods on the way to find him, but he's lost. In his semi-consciousness, Matthew Marr hears Frank talking about Raffi and Bazzy, and fear jolts him, adrenaline coursing through him. His mind flicks through images. Scylla and Charybdis, Cyclops, the drowned men and their wooden Ithacan ship. He remembers talking to Raffi about Odysseus's voyage, comparing it to Raffi and Bazzy's journey, their Circe the broker in Syria, who said the route was safe. But those dangers are past. New dangers now. He'd thought they'd been evacuated, but they're in danger, and it's linked to Victor and the diary and to a word spoken in the corridor. Raffi told him about a devil in the Quran called Iblis, with immense hubris, but whose only power is to cast evil suggestion into men's hearts. Why is he thinking of Iblis? He sees the day with the blue sky, old school bright with flowers, a bird calling. He doesn't know what this day means, but he sees the darkness surrounding it, and it's hiding something. He feels someone gently stroking his face, and forces himself to go into the darkness further and further. And it brings him to the school corridor with the photos of boy soldiers. It's darker than normal. The lights are switched off. The corridor dim. Anna is with him. She was waiting for news of Raffi, maybe about to go and find him because she loves Raffi too. He's talking to the policeman in their gatehouse. Tobias is next to him, and he's trying to hurry Tobias along. The door closing. Which door? must be the door to the drawing room, which he thought was empty. Footsteps in the corridor behind them. Hannah goes into the library, but Tobias isn't moving. The footsteps continuing, getting closer. A click. The cock of a gun. He makes Tobias go into the library. He turns to face the man behind him. Balaclava covering his face. He's pointing a rifle, another gun like a machine gun strapped to his chest. The rigidity of hatred, so that the guns and his hate are the same.
Outside the main school, the police, guided by a pregnant psychologist, try to identify the attackers and find a motive for their actions. Blinded by the snow and with little communication to locate the different groups, they seem helpless at times. As events unfold, the focus of the narrative shifts between the groups and individuals who are isolated and can only guess at what is happening. Lupton paints a series of compelling portraits, from a mother waiting to hear news of her teenage son, to a 16-year-old Syrian refugee who rescues some of his fellow pupils but returns to the scene to find his younger brother. The sense of dread is excellently portrayed as the gunmen pace the corridors, their footsteps a constant reminder of the danger faced by the children and their teachers.
In the porter cabin, Beth feels faint and wants to black out. And then she'll come to in her old life, where she's in Maitrose and Jamie is at his school's dress rehearsal. Again and again, he doesn't answer his phone. Another police officer has come into the porter cabin, and she can tell that this young athletic woman blames her. And she's right to blame her, because with a different mother, this wouldn't be happening to him. And she'd give him up. Give up his babyhood and childhood, every day of him. Give him to another mother if it stopped this. She asks the athletic police officer if she can have a photo of Jamie today. She pretends to herself, as well as the police officer, it's so she can look at the photo and see that there's something of her boy in it, and she'll know for sure that they can talk to him. But truthfully, she has this hope, a lifeboat as her family drowns, that she'll look at the photo and it will all be a mistake, the wrong person. It won't be Jamie at all. Vandy comes into the command and control centre, her hair and her jumper covered in snow, and Rose realises that she's still wearing Thandi's corduroy jacket. She takes off the jacket and puts it across Thandi's shoulders. Beth Alton wants a photo of him, Thandi says. Bit late to take a good look at him now, isn't it? Another hefty thump to that punch bag. Rose catches Denisha's eye, both older women thinking Thandi harsh, because what could Beth Alton have seen? Jamie didn't shave his head, lace up his DMs and go on a white pride march. He's a floppy-haired, Converse-wearing kid who's doing props for his school play. There should be sacraments of evil, Rose thinks, showing outward visible signs of an inward invisible wickedness, so that parents would see the signs and stop their kids being groomed by white supremacists or ISIS or any other terrorist group. But Beth Alton suspected nothing, because everything is hidden. The searches on the Deakins and Alton's houses haven't found bookshelves in the gunman's bedrooms full of neo-Nazi literature and CDs of white supremacist music, because Mein Kampf, the Turner Diaries, Building a Whiter, Brighter World, Angry Young Aryans, Blue-Eyed Devils and their ilk are invisible on Kindles, iPods and smartphones. And the time has long since passed when there was a household phone in a hall or sitting room, where eavesdropping happened as a matter of course, and parents had an inkling of what their children were up to, what they were thinking. Thandi prints out two stills from UAV footage and leaves. The young athletic woman police officer opens the door wearing the corduroy jacket that Rose Polstein was wearing earlier, because they are still in a life where you lend a friend a jacket. She hands Beth a large envelope, and Beth asks if she can be alone. When the porter cabin is empty, she takes two photographs out of the envelope. They're large, like those professional family ones with the white background. Everyone's smiling and dressed in brightly coloured clothes, draped around each other. They have one in the hall, her and Mike and Theo and Jamie. The first photo is of a man in army combat clothes with ammunition slung around him, holding a big gun. There's a building in front of him. The second photo is a close-up of the man's face hidden by a black balaclava. She tries to imagine Jamie's voice, what he'd say to her. She didn't have to try before. It was remembering and daydreaming, a kind of empathetic talking. All she can see are his eyes in the cut-out holes in the balaclava, the same hazel as Jamie's eyes, with thick lashes, the same eyelashes.
Lupton studied English literature at Cambridge and began her working life as a reviewer for the Literary Review. She moved on to the Royal Court Theatre after winning Carlton Television's New Writers Award and worked as a screenwriter before publishing her first novel, Sister, in 2010. This was an immediate success, a bestseller in both the Sunday Times and the New York Times, and has been translated into 30 languages. Her later novels, Afterwards and The Quality of Silence, were equally well received, and she is considered one of the best emerging thriller writers in Britain. What sets her work apart from many thrillers is the human element. Although 3 hours is almost relentlessly exciting, embedded in the story are actions and reflections on courage, love, and sacrifice for others. The characters are very well drawn, and with few words, they become real and important to the reader without interrupting the flow of events. She also displays a good understanding of the psychology of some perpetrators and the insidious nature of those that groom the vulnerable, using them for their own purpose. This aspect of the novel is one of the most chilling, lifting it above the idea of good versus evil to show how fragile the personality can be. 3 hours is an extraordinary book on many levels. The setting is excellent, the characters well drawn, and the story is compelling. The ending does perhaps stretch the imagination a little, but it is still a terrific read, and I'm just about to start on another of Lupton's book. I hope it's as good as 3 hours.
Without any further ado, let's move straight to Rob Nichols for your views and thoughts on this almost cinematic and almost tragic, but not quite, epic.
Yes, definitely cinematic and definitely a modern classic and a really gripping thriller with an awful lot of questions to... very contemporary questions, and as Jenny said, very interesting the way it's split between the different settings, and you get people splintering and making comments or questioning things in ways that you wouldn't, well, unfortunately, you might expect, actually, but you wouldn't maybe really expect to read in a book, because it's such an incredible grasp of a scenario that's... We would often think of as something we would switch on the news and it would happen in USA, and actually we would just think it might happen every month in the USA, sadly. But this is, to put it somewhere in Somerset, in the middle of winter, surrounded by snow, surrounded by wooded area, and the shock that it happens in a school, that the principals of the school are so starkly against everything that this attack is about, really. This is a school that's based on, well, it's based on principles so far, first of all, and it's based on tolerance, complete tolerance, and a headmaster that goes out of his way to welcome people from... he's actually taken in asylum seekers himself and actually gone and done this himself, and then so it's an absolute... it's appalling that this is visited on the school, and then the questions are: is that why it's happened to this school? Is that why this has been picked out? And to see people falling into camps so quickly, it's interesting to eavesdrop on that, and that is it's terrible to see, but we know that happens in our own times, and so it's almost like with all the parents waiting to hear, your thoughts are of one of these aircraft tragedies where there's a plane's gone missing, and you never you're watching at home on TV, and you occasionally see glimpses of all the families waiting to hear news, and getting increasingly desperate. But you just get the glimpses, and here you get the story from their point of view.
Yeah, indeed, some very key and important, pertinent observations there, Rob. I think clearly, historically, we have Hungerford, we have Dunblane. We're not immune in Britain to this kind of mass shooting. Yeah. Thankfully, it hasn't reached the stage of Columbine or any of the other numerous situations in the States. If I was tempted to be a little bit more rigorous in terms of just deconstructing the text, I do feel Upton at times tends to draw too many threads together. She's obviously done this from a very well-researched point of view. I clearly appreciated the irony, of course, of featuring the Scottish play. We don't dare say the word, but the Scottish play as not necessarily providing a whole range of key joys for the whole system. And I did feel that the sequence, no spoilers, but towards the end where the children are effectively marching through the woods in disguise as trees and so on, stretched credibility a little bit. I said at the start it might be cinematic. I can see it being cinematic. I can see it almost having a happy Hollywoodized ending. And I just wonder whether in terms of having a more sanitized ending, that takes away from the very pertinent and very contemporary messages of the issues relating to asylum seekers, issues relating to people who are challenged. And of course, that classic line, which is tragically so evident in so many atrocities, such as mass shootings, of, but they seem such a nice, quiet young person. We never thought they could possibly be them. Again, no key spoilers, but the fact that one of the main protagonists of this whole situation, there's disbelief until effectively it's clearly identified that he is him. Although that obviously that radicalization, the development that goes over a very sharp 3-hour period. I mean, clearly a very narrow time frame. Most of our novels take place over much longer time frames. Here it's something which, I mean, it certainly took me a lot longer than 3 hours to read it. I don't think it can be a rapid page turner, but it's a case of one needs to assimilate the ways in which the things are coherently presented and put together. And of course, again, there is an ambiguity about the ending to a certain extent, insofar as we think there may well, there clearly has been, one of the protagonists who has effectively gone away and escaped and worked through that process. We see a kind of reveal in terms of that. So again, you have two people who've been used, arguably abused, and then manipulated, and then effectively receive their just rewards to a certain extent, and we're still left with the uncertainty. So again, lots of things that were put into the mix, which almost but didn't quite work for me. Rob, let's talk characters. Anybody particularly strike you as favourite? I thought Hannah was very good, because anybody who could effectively support her head teacher to that extent has got to actually get thumbs up from that point of view.
Yeah, absolutely. And incredible bravery and selfless bravery, even though she questions that herself. And obviously her boyfriend, Rafi, who puts his brother and Hannah above his own safety. And that comes out, doesn't it? The bravery of people and not thinking twice about putting themselves in the line of fire, literally. And so many characters doing that. And it's great that through the book we learn more about the journey that Rafi and his young brother and his family have gone through. And I think at this time, the way that the world is, the way that Britain is, to read that backstory, because that doesn't, we read so often, we just see the words asylum seekers. We don't see that them as people. And this book is brilliant in the way that it shows them as people and shows them as a family. And it shows the incredible struggles that they went through, and also the trauma of the actual people smuggling, and that they're victims, very much victims, and how they carry this forward. And that was a lot of people coming at the moment, aren't they, into this country from Ukraine. And a lot of those people will be carrying a lot going on in their heads. And this gives us a little bit of understanding, I think, of the kind of things that people have been through and are still going through and still working through.
And indeed, with respect to the Ukraine, I gather that people who they are allegedly staying with can no longer afford to actually keep their Ukrainian new housemates because of the fuel costs. But that's another issue for another time. Jenny, you've heard a couple of interesting lines there in terms of our viewpoints and perspectives. As I say, for me, doesn't quite reach a five-star golden rating because of the areas which I think were very stylishly put together, and I could appreciate, as a student of English literature, Lupton effectively managing to almost, to a certain extent, manipulate the audience, work through the readership, etc. But I do feel that Rob's points are also very valid, and this is a story that needs to be told, and maybe the fact that there are only two refugees that we see here from Syria is quite significant in terms of obviously the interactivity and the relationship within that. Anyway, as somebody who's been in education as well as a key writer yourself, your own thoughts on this?
I agree. I think that's a pivotal point in the story, and it is very, very well told. It's actually one of the most strongly resonating versions of that I've seen. The only other one was Russell Tovey in Years and Years, when he's on the boat and he drowns crossing the channel, which was a real shock. And some of the stuff in here had that same kind of visceral hit. That was excellent. As far as my favourite character is concerned, I like the pottery teacher who stands in this glass and wooden shed and makes great slabs of tiles to put up against the windows, which makes the little ones feel safer. That is astonishingly brave. She can see somebody outside with a semi-automatic rifle, and she starts putting pottery slabs up against the window. I think all the teachers were good, but I thought she was terrific.
Yeah, fair point. I also have to say it may well be a case of bias, because one of my earliest school performance roles was actually as a tree, so maybe it was too close to home in terms of that. I lack the other area. I know people have said my acting has been wooden ever since, but never mind. That's another perspective to be considered. Are there any other sort of issues? I mean, did you feel that the ending was satisfying, Rob? I mean, again, I felt it maybe stretched credibility to a certain extent in terms of almost they all lived happily ever after. apart from obviously the two villains of the piece, or two of the three villains.
Well, I'm trying. I don't want to give anything away, Alex, but I thought I did like the ending. I did. I thought it built. It was 3 hours. It built towards a climax. Of course, I used to watch Time Team, which was 3 days, and this is distilled into an hour of TV. I thought it was very well. I'm not going to say credible or incredible, because I think, sadly, tragically, sieges that go on in schools and things in USA, that the endings are always sadly are always incredible, because I can't believe that those things could actually happen like that. But no, I thought it was dramatic. I thought she handled all the different parts of the story really well. I didn't get confused at any point. and for me, it was I thought it really gripped me, this book, and right to the end. I just thought it was thoroughly enjoyable, or thoroughly thought-provoking book.
Be particularly interested to find out what some of our other usual colleagues who sadly couldn't be on the show today would have made of it, certainly from a non-British perspective, because as you said, this does outline something which regrettably has become almost a kind of natural part of the curriculum in America, in terms of not only training for potential shootings in school, but also or terrorist incidents, but also dealing with them as well. Final point in terms of the police and the way in which they were actually portrayed. Obviously, we had Thandi, who we heard in one of the readings was somebody who was seen as very much the person who was the go-getting side of things. The more mature police were seen as being more reflective on the whole process. Do you feel that was they were given a realistic overview of the whole piece, Rob?
Do you know what, Alex? When I was reading this, I was actually invited to Stoke City versus Middlesbrough by the police to oversee their policing operation. And it was bizarre. I just read about the different bands of commands, the gold, silver and bronze. And then I was thrown straight into it with the silver addressing the bronze and seeing the whole operation from the briefings for the senior officers to the briefings for all the police. And it really was so, not just the language, but so much about the way that the police handle things. So I was looking at something that was ostensibly a 90 minutes match day, but the planning had started long before. And in the same with this instance, although that was it's a 3 hour long siege, the planning in many respects, all the training has happened for months and years beforehand. So it was really interesting to see the same things and to see that and obviously going into a control room, you see that the police are normal people eating their sandwiches or whatever, but they're very astute. Their observations, the way they relate everything, the way they communicate, it was really interesting to be in the, you know, those two worlds at the same time. I almost sort of said to the police, "Oh yes, I know about that," because I've just and thought, no, I, it'll take a while to explain. Maybe take 3 hours to explain.
And there are various subtle levels to Book of the Month, which clearly the more discernible can actually pick out, you know, from the discerning listenership in terms of the codings that are actually there. Yeah. We know this. it is a matter of course. Jenny, finally, the juxtaposition of both the teachers, which you've already mentioned, and the parents, and in particular the parent of the child who's deemed to be one of the radicalized, who actually has been in a sense corrupted. Did you feel that was effectively produced? And again, the sense of shock that was felt, and also the internal monologue and the internal dialogue that Lupton addresses between the two characters, the mother and son, and obviously the disbelief. Did that work for you?
Yes, very much so. The anguish of the mother as she waited to make sure her son was okay, to get some news, and gradually more and more of them were taken out of the room, more and more parents left to meet their child, and she was left on her own. I mean, that was really, really telling.
I have a suspicion I might be the curmudgeonly one on this, although I enjoyed it. I will give it an 8.5. Rob, what's your score?
9.5, Alex. It's the best book I've read in 12 months, I would say.
High praise indeed. Jenny, are you going to go higher?
I'm going to go to 9 because I am a little bit iffy about the ending. A bit of the ending.
Indeed. And I think I've done extraordinarily well not actually revealing the whole thing. So that's all good. And finally, what are we going to be looking at for September as far as the Book of the Month is concerned?
Next month, Book of the Month is Peter Kerr's Don't Call Me Clyde.